I've been introduced in very extravagant terms, you know. I'd welcome a man who's going to bring us straight out of the presence of God. And I think, okay, no pressure then.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
You're listening to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. I'm the editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. That's the magazine that sponsors this show, and you can read this interview in the latest print edition as well. I'm delighted to say that my guest today, right here on The Profile, is Graham Kendrick. Graham has been described as a father of modern worship music, whose songs are crammed full of poetic, divine, biblical truth that have sculpted a view of God that has impacted generations. For more than 30 years, Graham's been at the forefront of Christian music, both here in the UK, having written and recorded hundreds of songs, but he's also well known around the world for his tracks, including Shine Jesus Shine, Knowing You, The Servant King, and Amazing Love. This month, Graham is marking 50 years since his first album, Footsteps on the Sea. And in order to mark the occasion, Graham has collaborated with Jake Isaac to produce a new EP of story songs. And it includes a new version of the song that started it all, Simon's song, Footsteps on the Sea. That EP has just been released. It's called Where It All Began and is available on all the usual streaming platforms. We're going to talk a little bit about that EP as well as Graham's wider life and career in music. Delighted to say that he joins us right here on The Profile to discuss all that and more. Graham, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
We always like to go back to the beginning on The Profile and hear actually about a person's early life growing up. Can you tell us something of your story? What was your experience of God like as a child?
Well, my father was a pastor, a Baptist pastor, and I was a third child, and so I was born in Northamptonshire, a little village called Blisworth, and he was the pastor of the Baptist chapel there. So that was my home for the first few years. It was actually there that I made my first kind of personal step towards Christ. You know, when you're a child, you grow up in a Christian home and it's just part of your life. You imagine that everybody goes to church and sings hymns or choruses or, you know, hears Bible stories or something. So I remember one night my mother, must have been a Sunday night, I think my dad was probably preaching in the evening service, and myself and my older sister and brother were at home, and she would typically read us a story. And there was a story which was in which the main character came to faith and learned about the Christian faith. So it was a great children's storybook. And I remember she came to the end of the chapter where the main character had made a step of faith. And she closed the book and she said, "Well, children, do any of you want to do what the character in the book did?" And sounded like a good idea. It's my mother, after all, you know. but she was wise enough to say, "Well, you better just pray by yourself. You know, I'm not going to do it for you." I think I remember going off to just a corner of the room and kneeling down and praying. And I can't remember the words I prayed, but I was saying, "Yes, you know what I just heard about in the story. I want that, you know." And I can remember something, it was like something exploded in my chest, you know. I thought, "Oh, something happened," you know. And when you're a child, when you're sort of 5 years old or so, you know, you don't have the words, you just remember it. And that is imprinted on my memory to this day. Something happened when I prayed as a child. And it was a beginning. So obviously, you know, growing up through, we went on to another church and another church. And as you grow up, you discover that not everybody believes the same thing. So your faith gets tested. But I've been, you know, I understood that you had to be willing to stand up for what you believed. And there were occasions. I was a very shy little boy. But I remember in one class, I think it must have been in primary school. Or maybe early in the secondary, but a teacher sort of said, "Any of you here Christians?" You know, And I stood up and said, I am, you know, everyone looks at you and thinks, you know, well, we're not, I mean, this was the 60s by then probably, or, you know, it was the beginning of the kind of casting off anything which was from the past, and the church and Christianity was like, oh, we've had it with that stuff, you know. But so it was important for me to stand up for my faith.
And do you remember at what time you had an interest in music? So obviously your faith was a very early age, 5-6 years old. Did you have an interest in music from that young as well?
It was there. My father is a very good self-taught pianist, and he used to play the piano, accordion as well. So he was kind of one of those all-in-one pastors, you know, the pastor who preaches,
yes,
and pastors, and
there's a lot of great pastors like that out there, probably listening right now, and we salute you, the pastors who lead the worship and do the preaching and everything in between.
Absolutely, absolutely, and I can, because so it was there, the hymns were there, the children's choruses with. He called Sally the Squeeze Box. That was the name as far as the kids were concerned for the piano accordion. But I can remember, you know, a memory that sticks in my head was on a Sunday evening, I guess, there was sometimes an after church gathering at the pastor's house. And before we went to bed, we were able to be there for a little while. I remember he, on one occasion, certainly, he probably usually did it, he pulled the piano out into the middle of the room, took the panels off to get more volume. And it's equivalent to turning up to number 11, you know.
Yes.
And then people would gather around the piano, and I'd be sitting on the floor with my brother and sister, you know, just in the corner, with this booming piano. And all these voices and people shouting out their favourites and singing in harmonies and so on. Just a very ordinary local Baptist chapel in the village, but people just love singing. And they knew all the songs, so they didn't actually give the tithe, they shouted out the number, because everyone knew what their the number of their favourite song was. So yes, I soaked it up. I had not such a great experience with piano lessons. And the teacher kind of gave me up, really. And simply because I wasn't making the connection between the lines and the dots and the sounds. But I had a really good ear. Somewhat later, I picked up the guitar. And I think it was one of the stuck in a wardrobe somewhere and was needed gluing together, but my dad did that for me. And so I started to make my own way. I thought, right, I'm going to get some sounds out of this thing. I don't want lessons, you know. I don't want that pain anymore. And that's probably the best thing for me, because just starting with 6 strings and a general idea that there are chords, I started just responding to the sounds.
Well, I'm very jealous of that, Graham, because my own music background is I can just about read music, but I'm terrible at playing by ear. So the fact that you have that ear for music, which I know a lot of musicians do, is incredible. And I've seen it done where musicians will just be listening to a song, pick up their instrument and just start playing along with no music. It's a real gift. Do you remember writing your first song?
No, I don't. When I started writing, I was probably about 15 years old or something, and in the Baptist church in Southwest London at that time. And what was happening in the sort of Baptist network of churches, and that was kind of our world, you know. Remember, there's no social media, you know, you've got 2 channels on the television and on your black and white television or something. And so your world becomes, you know, the other Baptist churches you connect with and the events that draw you, you know, together. And this was the 60s, and you know, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones were bursting on the scene, youth culture, everything was changing culturally in a big way. And in that network there were people just a few years older than me who were starting to use music to connect with young people who were no longer coming to church, you know. And coffee bars sprang up, Christian coffee bars. You'd convert the church hall, you know, you'd unscrew the bulbs and put coloured ones in and hang up fishing nets or something like that. And you'd create a sort of a vibey atmosphere. And then you'd print flyers and go out on the streets because, you know, nothing much to do out there. So kids were willing to come in, free coffee, hear a band. And I was one of those bands. So we, you know, we copied that trend, formed our own little band with my sister Julie and my brother Peter and Richard, a friend, and one, two, a Margaret, one, a few folks, you know, youth, the youth group, a few people in the youth group. That's what you do. And then you need songs because all these bands have got their own style. Some are folk bands, some are sort of progressive, heavy, you know, just anything you can imagine. So I guess out of necessity, I started to, you know, to write some songs so we didn't have to just copy other people's that weren't particularly our style. And so just by trial and error, really. And of course, when you play a song to a few of your mates and they say, oh, that's quite good. You suddenly swell with confidence. I think I told my mother when I was about 15 that I wanted to be a songwriter. And, she's very positive that I had an ambition, but it wasn't, I don't think, the one that she had in mind. I must say my parents were very, very generous-hearted in that they wanted us to thrive in what we really wanted to do. So there's no pressure to be this or that, you know.
Yeah.
The idea of being a songwriter, I don't think you'd ever heard that you could do that, you know, as a career or something.
Yeah. And these songs early on, because I think some people might be surprised, no, you haven't only ever just written worship songs. These songs early on, and certainly the first album that you released, it wasn't really worship music in the way that we might understand it today, was it? It was more story-based. Do you want to explain a bit of that?
Yes. It was an era of the singer-songwriter. You know, the music we were listening to on our transistor radios on pirate stations, you know, because the BBC wouldn't play it. You know, you were hearing things. Obviously, the Beatles were there, and then they began to go into that sort of whole storytelling era, Eleanor Rigby and so on. But there was also Simon and Garfunkel, you know, Paul Simon is a great storyteller in songs. Joni Mitchell. I gravitated towards that, that narrative storytelling sort of vibe. And I think it appealed to me because I'd been brought up on the Bible stories. I loved creative writing. It's probably my favorite thing at school, you know. I gravitated towards that. And when the little band that we had broke up because everyone went their separate ways to college and so on, I had no context to sing my song because I didn't used to sing, actually. My brother and sister used to sing and one or two others in the band. So I traded in my electric guitar for an acoustic guitar and started to write songs, just write songs. And I was very, very nervous about singing. Took me years to find my voice, you know, just through sheer terror, I think, of singing. But because no one else was going to sing them, and they were a bit quirky and individualistic anyways, you know, so they were my kind of song, and no one else was quite singing that, that I knew. So I had to sing them myself. I can remember I think I did one of those songs in the latter days of the band that we had, which, by the way, we had a wonderful name called the Whispers of Truth, which is kind of in a sort of, we had that in a kind of psychedelic lettering on the drum, on the bass drum and stuff like that. But I remember, you know, I'd do a one song solo spot, borrow my sister's guitar, and just sing this story about somebody who, you know, was off to find the meaning of life, kind of thing, you know.
Yeah. I love talking about this kind of era, 1960s, 1970s.
Yeah.
Like you said, Christians opening up coffee shops because that was the cool thing to do, and this kind of underground music scene. I love all that because that's part of our history, actually, at Premier Christianity Magazine. We started life as Buzz Magazine way back in 1965. Okay. Yes. I don't know if you remember Buzz.
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, that was, it started as just a sort of broadsheet to connect the bands around London and around the country. So there'd be an ad in there, you know, Vox AC30 amp for sale, or, you know, Gibson guitar or something like that. And we all started connect, and guys like Pete Meadows and Jeff Shearn and Dave Payne and John Webb, they were very entrepreneurial, and they formed something called MGO, Musical Gospel Outreach, very much an evangelistic heart. Because that's what the bands were doing. That was the motivation. And they started running workshops and running tours, and they formed a record company. So my very first album, I mean, I got asked to go on one of their tours. I think it was with Nigel Goodwin, who's a poet and sort of a performance poet, and Judy McKenzie, who was a really great singer-songwriter of the day. And they wanted a guitarist, and they recruited me, which wasn't perhaps the greatest idea, but it put me on the tour. And on the tour bus, as you're traveling long distances, you know, people start strumming songs. And so I got to play a few of my singer-songwriter songs, which they didn't really know about. And this is the nearest I can get to the big break story, okay? Was this on one of these tours, we were due to, scheduled in a few days' time to be at Westminster Central Hall, quite a major venue, certainly in the context of those days. And there was American bands who stole our name, actually, because we previously, the Whispers of Truth, were called the Forerunners, and then they came along and... anyway, we were happy to let them. We changed our name. Anyway, they couldn't make it. I don't know why it was, but for some reason they couldn't come. So there was a gap in the program, and the guys who were running it approached me and said, "How about, you know, would you be willing to do just like 15, 20 minutes? You know, and that's about all I could fill actually at that time with songs." And I did, and it went down well enough for them to say, "Let's make an album," you know. So that was the Footsteps on the Sea album,
and that was your first album, yeah. Just going back to something you said about the song, the storytelling songwriters, and you mentioned Simon Garfunkel and others in the mainstream who were doing that. If we look at the music scene today, both in the mainstream and certainly in the Christian world, you could argue that kind of storytelling just isn't around as much. I mean, just before coming on air, I was listening to one of your songs on YouTube, and there was a comment from someone who said, "Wow, Graham, this song of yours, you know, that told, I think it was one of Jesus' parables, said I never really understood that parable until I heard your song, and your song explained it." And I think the commenter said, you know, "Can you go back to writing those kinds of songs rather than the worship stuff?" And it's interesting because certainly when you look at the Christian music scene now, you could argue a lot of it is this kind of God-focused worship, which we'll come on and talk about in a moment. But both in the Christian and arguably in the mainstream, there isn't that same kind of you tell a story through song, is there?
Yeah, I think it is true. I mean, obviously, you've got two genres. You've got the kind of... congregational worship genre, which is one thing, and then you've got the more performance concert type thing. And certainly in those early days, it was the concert thing that was happening. You know, this was pre the praise and worship explosion, which really happened sort of from the late 70s into the early 80s. And it was all about, that was all message music, really. For me, it was a means to communicate with the folks around me. For example, I started writing those songs at college, right? So I'm a student, I'm a teacher trained in college. We have a very active Christian union. We're really trying to reach out and share our faith. And actually, we were the biggest organization on campus, actually. We did all sorts of stuff. But there was an opportunity there to, if you wanted a conversation, it was no good just stating your beliefs. You had to draw people in. I think it's still true, really. And telling a story in a song is a great way to start a conversation, you know? So I would write a song like Simon's song you mentioned earlier, describing when Simon Peter encountered Jesus by the shores of Galilee and his life completely changed, you know? And it worked as a kind of folk club story song, but everyone, by the time you finished it, people are sort of thinking, yeah, I think there's more to this song than just this Simon guy. I think I've heard, oh yes, I think this is about Jesus. But if you could win people with the song, they'd give you a hearing. If the song was rubbish, I think they wouldn't be interested, you know?
And do you remember, it may not have been as stark or as obvious as this, but do you remember there being a point in your life where you went from doing those story songs to you sort of looked around and think, oh wow, I am now writing worship songs, and actually there's this thing called being a worship leader, which may not have even really existed when you started out. Do you remember that kind of transition?
It was a very gradual thing because I went full time with my singer songwriter thing in 1972. And already there was a renewal movement brewing in the churches. People started talking about being filled with the Holy Spirit. And you know, that in my background, with all the great Bible teaching and all that we did have, there wasn't a great deal of experience of the Holy Spirit. And I was really hungry for that. I was fed up with reading about it in books that other people experienced this and that, you know? I wanted to taste it myself, you know? And that set me on a journey, which ended up with me being filled with the Holy Spirit. And that was a release moment, okay? Definitely. And I suppose what happened there is that I began to engage in, I'd be, whether it was a house group or a meeting or something, we would worship in a different way than I was used to, you know? This was much more... it was like waiting on God. It was like worshiping God with simple songs while you waited for the Spirit to do something, you know? And a lot of people who wanted to be filled with the Spirit would come to meetings like that, and often the Spirit of God would touch them just in the worship. It was a way of receiving. And it didn't matter how long you went on or how often you repeated the song, because it was all about encountering God. So this was happening. Meanwhile, I was doing my singer-songwriter thing. A little later on, in the 70s, I was in a team, a traveling mission team. And we were like a little traveling church, in a sense, only about 10 or a dozen of us. But, you know, we worshiped together. We were very close because we were so busy. You know, you had to do a two-week mission, have a couple of days, and go off to the next one, you know. But we were working with local churches, so I got the job of leading the communal singing, you know, and using some of these songs that I'd heard and picked up from the little home groups and so on. So I was cutting my teeth as a worship leader, because I already had skills as a performer, so it was a matter of extending those into this thing of, now I need to get the people singing. But in that little team, there were moments when maybe it was something someone was going through, I would write a song for them, or something we were struggling with. And I remember, as every team does, you know, you have relational, struggles sometimes, and you have tensions in the room when you're supposed to be praying. You know, the meeting's starting in 20 minutes, and you know, not everybody's happy with everybody else, you know. And I remember in the middle of that, a song came to mind, and it was a prayer. Jesus, stand among us at the meeting of our lives. Be our sweet agreement at the meeting of our eyes. You know, Jesus, we love you, so we gather here, and so on. And I sang it, and it helped us. It helped us to get Jesus in the center, you know. And there were a few songs like that that would kind of naturally arise. And then they would get on the grapevine. And the way the grapevine worked with the latest technology of the day, which was the overhead projector.
The OHP.
The OHP.
How we have fond memories of it, and the acetates being backwards and the wrong way around.
Absolutely. What it did, because, you know, previously it was the era of hymn books, and you get a new edition maybe once a generation, you know, 25 years or something, you get the new edition with some new songs in, some old ones bumped off. But suddenly, just in the time it would take to scrawl the words of a song, you could flash it up and you could just, there it is, you've got your words. And, you know, that's how songs spread. So a few of mine, among many others, like Dave Bilber and Chris Bowater and so many others, were doing the same thing in their little context. So songs started to just get out on the grapevine, and that's how mine began. But there was a moment, you know, if, as I say, this is a long journey, but I remember... actually, in 1978, the folks who were doing I was doing an album maybe once a year or something like that. And one of the guys I was working closely with was Jeff Shearn. And I happened to mention that I'd been writing these songs. And he said, oh, okay, that's interesting. And as a result, we actually did a worship album. This was 1978. So that was my very first worship album, Jesus Stand Among Us. That song I just described was the title track. And I just about had enough songs to fill that album. So that was 1978. But 1979, the first spring harvest happened. I'd been working with Clive Calver in this team, and he'd become the National Director of British Youth for Christ. And Pete Meadows, who founded Buzz Magazine and done all these other things entrepreneurially, the two of them got together and conceived this idea of a kind of a youth festival with seminars, you know, something like that. And they called it Spring Harvest. So in 1978, Clive and I went on some epic tour of 55 dates or something with boxes of flyers for this new event. And I'd written a song called God Put a Fighter in Me. And it was all about, come on, folks, there's a battle to fight. You know, there's a mission we've got to engage with. And it was a call to discipleship and to action and to giving your life to, you know, spreading the word of Christ and so on. So Spring Harvest happened, but it was more like a kind of a Christian Woodstock. You know, it was about 3,000 people, you know, a tent and some seminars at the Butlins Holiday Center. But a lot of the program was bands, one after the other, which was great because that was what was happening in the day. But I remember Clive coming up to me one evening when I was due to do a 40-minute set of my singer-songwriter songs. He said, Graham, we have a problem. We've got all these great bands and we love them, but the people want to worship. You know, there's just a hunger rising. People just want to worship. They love the music, but they actually want to participate in something. Would you mind giving up your set and your performance set and just going out and leading some worship? And, you know, I did have to sort of take a bit of a deep breath and think, okay, because my image of myself is much as the artist. I am the singer-songwriter. I also lead a bit of worship on the side, you know, when necessary. Happy to do that. Love it. But yeah, that was my... But I knew it was what I had to do. And moments like that, I think, set another ball rolling, because the response back, and particularly to the songs I've written, it was like a new generation wanted to give voice to worship in terms of their own culture.
Yeah.
And I was just there.
Yeah. And it's remarkable to reflect back on that moment, I think, because of what's happened since. Because since that moment, that kind of hunger for worship, it has, to use the modern terminology, it has kind of gone viral, not just in the UK, but internationally. You think, well, now when Christians gather, it is to worship. You look at the biggest Christian events and conferences and churches, and a huge amount of time and money investment now goes into, we want to sing together. We want to corporately sing worship to God. And you, as you so well described there, that wasn't the norm, even at that first spring harvest. It was, no, you'd go along and you'd watch some Christian singer-songwriters. So you think the change there has been dramatic. Mm. And I suppose this is why, as I said at the beginning, you have been described as a father of modern worship music because of that experience that you describe at somewhere like Spring Harvest. How do you feel when you hear that term, a father of modern worship music?
I wonder what I might get blamed for, I suppose.
We'll come on to that in a moment, actually.
And there were many fathers, you know, around the world. You know, the folks that started Scripture in Song off in New Zealand. The Jesus Movement, the West Coast of America. There was so many that came out of that, you know, that started to write worship songs, Maranatha music, and Jim and Carol Owens, and their musicals that kind of took a different kind of worship out to the churches, a different, you know. So there were many fathers and mothers out there. I guess you can't just say it's an accident of history, but you don't set out to be this or that. You just take the next step and look back and see, well, I suppose you could describe it like that. But at the time we were just doing the next thing that we felt we should do.
Yeah. It's funny you said a moment ago, you wonder what you might be blamed for. And I did want to ask you both the positive and the negative, I suppose, of the last 50 years of what we now understand as this modern worship movement, by which I mean modern songs. Again, things that people of my generation might take for granted, that they could go to a charismatic evangelical church, there'd be a kind of style of music, but also what you described as this renewal that happened in the 1970s and 80s that, again, people of my generation would take for granted because this is just normal church. And actually, you described really well there how, you know, there was this moment in kind of recent church history where there was this move of the Spirit and everything became quite different. But nevertheless, reflecting on that, on this modern worship movement and all that came with it, over the past decades, what are your reflections, both positive and perhaps more critical or negative, of how things have changed in the church world that you are pleased about and proud to have been a part of, and other elements that you think actually we might need to rethink that, or perhaps concerned about the direction we've gone in certain ways?
I think one of the interesting things about the context it started in is that the big emphasis in my teens and whatever, it was very much Bible teaching, right? And there was still a lot of sort of preaching centers where people would travel to hear great preachers. And I used to go down to hear David Pawson at Millwood Center when I was a student, and just loved hearing good Bible teaching. And I remember in the more evangelistic outreach way, you know, Gordon Bailey, who passed away last year, I believe, was an outstanding communicator and did masses in schools. But he was an amazing storyteller, so he could take a Bible story and have you rolling in the aisles and then make his point, you know. But I think the point is that this renewal movement happened in groups of people who are very much Bible people. So you were soaked in the Word, and then you got the Spirit. You put the Word and the Spirit together, it's absolute dynamite, you know? And I think what has happened, because the experiential then began to become much more prominent, that the teaching of the Bible started to get sidelined, you know. And it seemed to be, or it felt like, I'm not saying this how it really was, but it felt like where it was really happening was when you worshipped, the Spirit came, stuff happened, and that was absolutely true. But I was fortunate enough to be 20 years in a church in London from the mid-80s called the Ichthys Christian Fellowship, founded by Roger and Faith Forster. And I think they had a great balance with the Bible teaching and the worship and the intercession and the outreach and the mission and so on. But I think where the experiential takes over, if you like, the Spirit takes over, the emphasis on the Spirit takes over from the emphasis on the Word, it's easy to lose the plot. I mean, and I say lose the plot, I mean literally, because the Bible is a story. We have a story to tell. You know, when Paul talks about the gospel he preaches, he goes straight back to, you know, to Christ, God incarnate, died on a cross, buried in the tomb. It is the story. That is the unique thing about the gospel. It is a story based in history, in time and space. There are endless experiences to be had out there in the world. But there is only one story that says God was made flesh. And it is the telling of that story and the stories around it. And the Bible is a book of stories that actually becomes the framework for how we should live our lives, not just the subjective experiences. So I've always tried to put a big emphasis on telling the story. And if I can write a worship song that puts the personal experience and response within a Bible story, it might just be a reference to a Bible story, but it's there. You know, you could trace back to the Bible passage if you wanted to in the song. I think that's a really important thing. And I think actually some of the best, it's not that it's not happening. I think maybe it's my perspective, all the songs I like, but there have been a lot of good songs by some of the really famous song producing churches and movements that tell the story brilliantly. And those seem to be, in my mind, those seem to be the ones that we sing a lot and we really need them. But there are more stories to tell. That, you know, the core one, obviously the incarnation and the crucifixion and the resurrection and the return. But around that, there are masses of untold. What's a phrase I wrote down a while ago? The unsung Jesus. What about the Jesus we don't sing about or the stories we don't sing about? And because we're not a Bible literate church now in the way that we used to be, if we don't sing it, do we even know that those stories exist, you know? So we have to restore the balance, I think.
Yeah.
And you can't do it all in songs. One of the guys who was a sort of one of the many mentors in my earlier days feels quite strongly that there used to be a worship leading, a lot of these Bible weeks, where you had the worship leader and then you had other leaders with other giftings who would be expected, if they felt this has something from God, to interrupt the worship leader and bring a word and then hand back again. Or maybe the meeting might go off in a completely different direction. I think it's got a good point. And I think this probably happens in many good local churches, but you get the impression that you hand over to the worship leader and the band, yes, and that's it. That's everything.
And they do what they like.
But, you know, I grew up with team ministry, and I believe apostle, prophet, pastor, teacher, evangelist. We have to have these gifts. They're not all platform gifts, but we need those different gifts to bring the balance. I think the other thing that has happened is that I think we've now come to an expectation that encounter with God, that you have to be worshiping to have an encounter with God, right? worshipping sun worship. Let's say sun worship, you know? And so rather than thinking, yes, we could encounter God just as much in the preaching or just as much in the liturgy or, you know, in the personal fellowship or in the reading of the word, you know, the load. And I felt that pressure as a worship leader, you know, that I've been introduced in very extravagant terms, you know. I welcome a man who's going to bring us straight out of the presence of God. And I think, okay, no pressure then, you know, but, and I've watched other worship leaders and done it myself. You get to a certain point and you've done what you've given it, you know, you felt you've had an anointing and you've given it, right? But there's still half an hour to go, you know, and you're obliged to carry on when perhaps we should be moving into intercession, or we should be moving into some teaching of the word or some exhortation or just someone say, okay, that's enough. Now go and do it.
Yeah.
You know? So we have, I think, got stuck into a box, you know, a kind of concert, arena concert box.
Yes.
Which it can be great in the right context, but it's not the whole story.
It's funny you mentioned that about timing, because it reminds me of something that Tim Hughes said when I interviewed him. He said, we got to this point where you go somewhere as a worship leader and you have 12 minutes and 30 seconds to do your thing. And then, you know, when the clock runs out, that's it. And again, it's the same point you're making, whether it's actually we can finish a bit early or we can overrun. It's the same point, isn't it? Of if we're going to be spirit led, then perhaps we shouldn't put too many parameters around these things.
Yes, I mean, I live in that kind of world of tensions, you know, because, you know, I might be at a festival, I might have a whole evening to do what I like with, or I might be leading in my local church on a Sunday morning, two services where you've got to finish the first one so there's enough time.
Yeah, and there's practical considerations, which is understandable.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and you've got the kids and the kids workers, and you know, you've got a timing, so you have to do that. So what do you do? Well, you find another space where you can be more free flowing, you know, you can, an evening where the kids aren't there and those who are able come and you can just worship, or you can have a prayer evening or healing evening or something. And without those kind of parameters. So we have to find other ways of doing it, because all these things are valid and important. So we live in that kind of tension. But it's hopefully a creative tension. But I think one other thing I would say is that in every generation, we have to be aware of what the dominant culture, which is obviously a secularized culture in the West, where that pushes us. And culture is something that becomes invisible. You don't realize how much you're being influenced by the way things are, you know? It's only when you maybe read a bit of history or look at something or visit another country where the culture is different, you suddenly realize, you know, I've been to countries in Asia particularly, which are very communal. And, you know, you suddenly realize, boy, we are so individualistic in the West, you know? And are we right and are they wrong? You know, but we have to be willing to step back, or we have to step back and evaluate our culture. And one of the elements of our culture is it has become very experiential. Experience is put above truth, you know. I grew up where truth was above everything else, you know, and there was a higher moral law that people assume, but now it's all down to the individual, you know. And I think we have to be careful that songs don't all become about us, you know, that we're in the center of the universe. It's like Copernicus, you know, and he got into a lot of trouble. He said, actually, you know, the sun doesn't revolve around the earth revolves around the sun, you know. And I think in our culture, we think everything revolves around us, and we think God revolves around us and runs after us just to give us all that we need because we're so important. But actually, like the earth rolls around and so we, God is the center of it all. And we need to keep remembering that.
More.
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 We often want more, but is it always a bad thing? Isn't wanting more knowledge a good thing?
What about more understanding?
More perspective.
More wisdom.
More action.
More inclusion. Discover more of the good things at the brand new Premier Christianity magazine website. So much more than a monthly magazine, Premier Christianity website helps you go deeper in your faith and is full of inspiration of what God is doing in the world today.
It's Premier Christianity, but so much more.
Register today at premierchristianity.com.
premierchristianity.com.
I'm sure you've probably never done an interview, Graham, where the words shine, Jesus, shine haven't featured. it is, of course, your most popular, most well-known song. And I'm sure you'll know this already, but it probably happens regularly. But I certainly remember a few years ago listening to a mainstream radio station and they're asking people for their primary school assembly bangers. And it was wonderful to hear people would ring into the radio show and say, oh, Shine, Jesus, Shine. And then the DJ would play a bit of Shine, Jesus, Shine. And people have these amazing memories, actually, of very, very young children. They can still, you know, years on, remember that song. Do you remember, did you hear that when that happened on the radio? What's your thoughts on this song that so many people, not just Christians, actually have very fond memories of?
Yes, I someone referred me to it, and I think I heard a few snippets of it after the event, and it was great fun to hear about it. I mean, it's always a great surprise that has happened, in the sense that it's a very Jesus song. You know, it's all about Jesus, you know.
Yes.
But somehow the kids just love it, and who don't know about Jesus. I'm just so grateful that it's put the name of Jesus on so many kids' lips and that they have a connection with it, even though they might just think, oh, it's a song, you know, it's a song like lots of other songs. So I think it's an amazing thing, and it's one of the things which gives me the most satisfaction to know that children, if you know, several generations, you know, have got that song into them inside them. And I have met people and heard people who that was their only connection, and in a moment of desperation, wanting to pray, but never having had any vocabulary of prayer, would pray with those words, and God met them, you know. And if I've heard a handful of those stories, there's probably a lot more. I hope so.
Yeah,
there's a lot more out there.
Yeah. And do you have any kind of inkling, you know, when you were writing a song like that, you know, do you have a sense of, oh, I think this one might kind of go a bit further than somewhere the song, you know, I think I'm onto something here.
I was a bit slow on the uptake on that, because, and I think because a lot of musicians, we're into stuff that's kind of a bit clever and or has got a really great tune or in, and at the time I was, you know, putting together an album, and I had other songs I was more excited about.
You hear this sometimes, don't you, of bands who have to play a particular popular song at every show and hate doing it because they don't actually like it, but it's their most popular song. I hope that's not the case for you.
No. I think what I had learned by that time was about road testing songs in the church I was in London. I was very privileged to be able to try out songs. We did have very long meetings, so it didn't matter too much if you spent 10 minutes in teaching a song at the beginning. And I would always listen for that sound, you know, if people, you know, are they really getting this? Are they starting to worship? And that's always what told me the story. And there was, you know, I remember a couple of times when you'd lead a song once, maybe you'd lead a song another time, maybe. And then it was like, wow, something came on that song, you know? And I think probably it was it was at Spring Harvest when I taught it, and it just went boom, you know, and people were just singing, and then it, you know, obviously had legs and started to run all over the place. But I wasn't expecting that. Mm. I mean, when I actually wrote that chorus, because I wrote it in two parts, I wrote the three verses like a hymn,
right?
And I tried that out, and I could tell that people thought, yeah, that's all right, yeah. that's okay, you know. But I knew it wasn't very special, and several people had said to me, and I thought I agreed with them that this is verses needing a chorus, you know. And when the moment came, when I was, you know, when the chorus unfolded, it did come unusually. Just the chorus part. I'd already written the verses, as I say, but the chorus came quite quickly, and with a sense of, ooh, you know, I felt it in my spirit. There was something special, but that, you know, and that did happen occasionally, you know. But I still couldn't tell where it was going to go.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk, of course, about the brand new EP in a moment. Just before we get there, though, I'm aware we're speaking quite a moment in history in terms of what we've lived through over the last couple of years now with COVID. And obviously, I've been asking everyone I interview about COVID, because how can you not? Mm. It's changed everything for everyone. And I imagine for you, before the pandemic, you were probably quite used to touring and leading worship. And of course, that would have changed overnight. Your whole career, your whole livelihood would have changed. So, you know, as we are hopefully now coming out at the end of this pandemic, what are your reflections, I guess on how COVID affected you personally? What has the last couple of years been like for you?
I think it was a shock to my wife as well, because I hadn't had 2 years without going away after a few days, you know, the traveling. There was a moment when she said, do you know, would you mind just going away for 3 days? Like, it was a joke, but I know, I think she was wanting a bit of the space she used to enjoy when I went. I think there were moments when I wondered, is this it? Am I, you know? And I even, I think partly because I wasn't using my voice very much, but I started to struggle with my singing, and I thought, am I losing my singing voice, you know? And you start seriously thinking, well, is this it? Am I supposed to retire now? Not that I've ever wanted to, but you wonder whether that's what's happening. Big adjustments, missing the stimulation, the demand of standing up in front of a crowd of people and interacting with them and going somewhere for God, you know. So there were moments of struggle, but at the same time, I started to read a lot more, which I hadn't done. I've always dipped, you know, in kind of research type reading, but I started to read books I wouldn't normally read. Looking back on it, now, I think it was a very important time of refreshment and change. And, you know, I was in a pattern, and I could imagine that pattern without the pandemic would have just gone on and on until I finally was too old and too decrepit, you know, to leave home or whatever. So I have felt this, you know, certainly personally, that there's been a refreshment in it. And in it, you know, I did do some more songwriting. I mean, I learned how to video myself.
Right, yeah.
Which I think became the most stressful thing I can imagine. Doing the visuals and the sound, trying to get a good result.
Yeah.
Had to be done. Some of these songs obviously were being written during that time. And it was refreshing. In fact, it was... before the pandemic, I was with Jake Isaac, who's a very, very talented singer-songwriter. And in fact, he grew up in the London church I was a part of as a youngster. So even at 14 years old, he might be drumming for, you know, as I led worship, is sort of age of my kids and whatever. Anyway, we got together and talked songwriting stuff, and I happened to play him Simon's song, that Footsteps on the Sea. And he really loved the song, and he said, I didn't know you ever wrote songs like that, you know? He'd never heard about that whole era. He got very thoughtful about it, so, you know, asked me, do I still write songs like that? I said, well, not really, because there's not much call for it. And so he sort of threw down a challenge. He obviously got something in his heart, you know. He said, look, if you write some more songs like that, I'd love to, if you let me, produce an EP of them. And I thought, well, that's pretty good, because he's a very, very talented musician and writer and producer and so on. So I said yes, and it gave me the motivation I needed to write some more story songs, and we recorded them and finished the recording, I think last October, and then thought, what do we do with this? until somebody in my circle said, oh, Graham, did you realize that next year, you know, 2022 is 50 years since your first album?
And you hadn't realized.
And I thought, okay. There's something going, because I knew God was in this somehow with Jake, but I didn't know what. But then I think it started to unfold that there was something to celebrate. So that I can tell the story. I think people need to know where you come from, particularly when you get older, because people think you just appear from nowhere and do what you do. And they don't realize, you know, it's important to know that, you know, there's a whole preparation time for all of us, you know, different stages, different phases, different seasons. And people that open the way for you, people that make possible what you do, without whom you probably wouldn't be doing what you do. So to be able to tell that story has been a real privilege.
Amazing. And that EP is out now. It's called Where It All Began. And as you say, it's a glimpse into some of your earlier music. So you've re-recorded, haven't you, that early song. And there's also some new material. Is that right?
That's right, Simon's song, and I wrote a song with Lucy Grimble called 4 Days, which is about Lazarus, one about Mary and Martha, and one set in the Garden of Gethsemane. So that
YouTube commenter I mentioned earlier in the program is going to get exactly what they wanted when they said, Graham, can I have some more storytelling songs?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that coming out.
That's great. Well, just before we go, I just had a couple of other questions really linked to the pandemic, I suppose, because the pandemic was a tumultuous time for everyone, as I mentioned. But it was sad to see, I think, there were a number of cases of church leaders, to quote unquote, falling from grace, some scandals even in the church, which was painful for a lot of people. I know when I interviewed your friend and colleague, Martin Smith, a couple of months ago, he spoke about how some of these pastors were his friends, and he had to watch as there were some really bad stories in the church. And it struck me that for yourself, as I say, reflecting back on so many years of music and Christian ministry, that you must, this is not new to you. And sadly, throughout church history and recent years, there are stories of actually people who we look up to in ministry and in church life, doing things that aren't right and being found out and being caught out. And I wondered if you had any reflections, especially for those who might be listening, who really struggle with this. And perhaps for them, it's a new thing, actually, to see, wow, there's this pastor I loved, or this Christian person in ministry who I really respected, either locally or internationally. And because I know for some Christians, when that happens, it can really rock their faith. And I wondered if you had any helpful thoughts on that, because, as I say, I'm sure this wouldn't have been the first time you would have heard some of these stories, because, as I say, sadly, and I know this as a Christian journalist, sadly, these things do happen from time to time. And it can be difficult, can't it, to wrestle with that and to find a way through.
Yes. And I can remember, you know, in my younger days, seeing people that I admired as Christian leaders and thinking they were perfect, you know. But it's nobody is, you know, and some of them, some people's gifting actually means they have bigger flaws, because they have a bigger gifting and maybe the bigger potentials for flaws. That doesn't justify behavior, but it's a reality that I think we have to be full of grace. You know, I think we have to recognize the grace that we all enjoy, and we have to be gracious and get. I know it sounds like a cliche, but you know, I'm following Jesus. You know, I'm not following that leader, and that leader will bring Jesus to me, but their job is to help me follow Jesus. So Jesus is the senior shepherd, you know, he's the chief shepherd. So we have to make sure we're following Jesus and not just following a personality. I think the other thing, it is a lesson for all of us in community, real community, where we're in genuine relationships. I always believed in being part of church, even when there wasn't a church nearby that I really related to well and I might have struggled with, but it was always my ambition. I've got to get my roots into church, into, you know, community of faith, into and as far as I can be accountable. And I think the isolation is the biggest killer, you know. And I think real relationships. I've been very blessed with, you know, when I was in my early 30s, an older Christian gathered a group of us together, and we started meeting 3 times a year. Just pray for each other and tell our stories and be honest and whatever. And we still meet all these years later, and it's a safe place of disclosure. You know, I'll say, excuse me, I'm really struggling, or, you know. So I think it's important to have those kind of relationships. But perhaps even, well, alongside that, I would say, I think we've neglected the inner life. I think we've put so much emphasis on the events and the big things that we all gather together and have a great time, or, you know, somebody, some great preacher or worship band gets up and brings us to a very special place. But what about our own, how do we sustain our own personal worship lives? And I realized when I first started working intensely on a team that when I went home, when I had a day off, my spiritual life kind of collapsed, because it was all built around the excitement and the ministry, and there was a, you know, anointing, what God did, and you're excited. But I hadn't developed a secret life with God. You know, I had nowhere to go when it was just me, you know. And I think Jesus put an emphasis on the secret place. You know, he said, you know, when you give, when you fast, when you pray, shut yourself away, and your heavenly Father who sees you in secret will reward you openly. You know, there's got to be a secret place. And it strikes me that if we don't become secret, if we don't have a secret communion with God, if we don't become secret worshippers, we could very easily become secret sinners. And if our lives are so intense and so busy, and we've become so important that we don't have time, you know, and I'm glad to say that I think there are a lot of people bringing that emphasis on the disciplines of prayer and worship and the Psalms. I think in the last 20 years, the bigger than ever in my life has been the Psalms and praying the Psalms. So I know, even though I don't want to do it, our sinful flesh does not want to pray. You know, we don't want to get aside and do this, but we have to. And I think the Psalms help us to do that. So I think, yeah, accountability, real relationships, community, local community, being known for who you really are, and then developing that inner life is going to help us to avoid these things.
That's a really profound place to leave it. I love what you say about the Psalms. If we had time, I would ask you about psalm surfing, which is something you've come up with. Maybe people will have to Google Graham Kendrick psalm surfing, and I'm sure there's some resources online. I'm so sorry out of time. But the new EP is out now, so do check that out wherever music is normally streamed from your whatever device you use. It's Where It All Began, the EP from Graham Kendrick. Graham, thank you so much for coming on The Profile. I've really, really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Sam, for having me. Bless you.
Well, thanks so much for listening to The Profile podcast today. It's been wonderful to have your company. Before you go, can you do me a massive favour and just take 20 seconds to give us a rating and a review wherever you found this podcast? It helps other people to discover the show. It would mean so much to me. So please just do that now. Give us a rating and a review wherever you found this. I would recommend a 5 out of 5, but I trust you to be honest, obviously. So please give us whatever you think we deserve. We're bringing you new interviews each and every week right here on The Profile podcast. A rating and a review helps other people to enjoy and discover the show for themselves. Have a great rest of your day, whatever you're up to, and we'll see you next time right here on The Profile.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Save big on landscaping projects at Menards. Transform your outdoor living space with easy, no-cut block projects. From fire pits and grill stations to planters and fountains, we offer hundreds of free project plans that are easy to build with no block cutting required. Check out our huge selection of concrete landscaping block at Menards. And view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.